two greatest documents in the world. That's not a TV guide and Kohl's advertisements, okay? Just in case you were wondering. They are the Bible and the Constitution of the United States of America. And in the Bible, its first sentence is this: in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And in the preamble to the Constitution, the first sentence is, we the people of the United States. God and people. In the beginning, God. And we the people. These two documents are the basis of our lives here and hereafter. The Bible sets forth the principles that guide and give and regulate our spiritual relationship and fellowship with God. The Constitution states the role of government in our lives, and the preamble states its purpose. And I have my Bible here, and I have a copy of the Constitution, as well as other documents such as the Declaration of Independence. It's amazing that this booklet contains the Constitution, Declaration of Independence, George Washington's farewell address as he was leaving office, and we have documents before our Congress today that trying to settle one issue is over 1,200 pages. Isn't that amazing? Extraordinary. It proves to me that truth doesn't have to be long-winded. Now, I hope y'all don't hold me to that this morning. But it is a principle that I have observed that sometimes the longer we talk, the less we understand. But in the preamble to the Constitution, there is the purpose for which we have a Constitution or as a nation. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty. The blessings of liberty. To ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. July the 4th, this coming Saturday, is Independence Day. And the Declaration of Independence is the day that the document was signed that stated the fact that we were tired of oppression, and that we would seek freedom from that oppression. What oppression? What do we mean the oppression that we freed ourselves from? Well, here's what the people articulated and enumerated. The history of the present king of Great Britain is a history of repealed and repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. Here's just some of those oppressive laws or actions. He has refused his assent to laws, the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. Now we're talking about the King of England. He has refused to pass other laws for the accommodation of large districts of people. He has called together legislative bodies at places unusual, uncomfortable, and distant from the depository of their public records. He has dissolved representative houses repeatedly for oppressing or opposing with manly firmness his invasion on the rights of the people. He has refused for a long time after such dissolutions to cause others to be elected, whereby the legislative powers incapable of annihilation have returned to the people at large for their exercise. I think there are about 18 of these, and in one of them there are a number of statements concerning the oppression under which the colonies were existing at that particular time. Whenever we think of oppression and how burdensome these must have been to our forefathers, on this day we will not forget, that is, on Independence Day, the God in whose will and providence we see plainly in our history of our nation. The Bible is seen in our documents, that is, our historical documents. But not everyone who wrote these documents were Christians, but all sought his guidance and his protection. That is, they recognized a sovereignty beyond themselves and a sovereignty beyond the King of England. And these two documents are the foundation of our public and private lives. Our sitting here together this morning is because the Constitution of the United States, as amended, denies legislation to any body, state or federal, that would interfere with our gathering together to worship God. And that's one of the extraordinary parts of our Constitution, because up until then, every government had insisted on having its preferred religion or its preferred brand of Christianity. Our people lived under that kind of oppression religiously for hundreds of years, almost two millennials, lived under the oppression of a state-controlled religious organization that told people when they went to church, how long they'd pray, what they'd wear, what they wouldn't wear, when they went, what they'd say, what hymns they would sing, what hymns they wouldn't sing, the offerings that would be taken, what they would be used for, all came down from government and from government regulation. That was oppression. So we've had freedom from political oppression, and we've had freedom given and gained in America from religious intoleration and oppression. But there's a question that is asked in the Bible that I think we ought to consider this morning, and that question is found in Psalm 11:3. It's very simple, very short. If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? In other words, when the foundations have ceased to exist, when they're set aside, what are righteous people going to do? What course of action do we have? If suddenly the government decides that we are an illicit religious organization and forbids us to meet, what are we going to do? What if they tell us that we must pay taxes into a general fund so that all of the religious groups in America have an equal opportunity and the rich churches can support the poor churches? We'll have one common source of funding, and we'll collect it by taxation. But there's just one problem. You cannot preach anything that denies the other's legitimacy. You can't preach that you're the only true organization in America. You have to level it out. We will collect the taxes. We'll pay your pastors. We'll pay your bills. We will help you with building a church, but there must be no partisanship, no argument about this is right and this is wrong. Because in religion, there are no rights, there are no wrongs according to the world. Everybody's right in religion because it's really unimportant. So unimportant that it has no foundation of truth. It's just religion. And what happens when our Constitution is ignored? It's short enough that anybody can read it. We have third and fourth graders that can read the Constitution of the United States in this congregation right now. And with some small guidance, comprehend what it means. But what shall the righteous do if our foundations are destroyed? And perhaps we might also attempt to answer the question, how can our foundations be destroyed? We've had one of our protectorates attacked, which is now one of our states, Hawaii. December the 7th, 1941, we had an attack from a foreign group, terrorists, which we can't say that anymore. And that's the only attacks we've had, and we've never been invaded, except maybe in the Mexican War, some bandits came across the border and we chased them back across the border. It wasn't much of a threat. We've never been seriously invaded like Britain has been invaded and France has been invaded and Italy's been invaded and Germany's been invaded and Hungary's been invaded and Czechoslovakia's been invaded and on and on and on. We've never suffered in that manner. And I believe that foundations are destroyed not by an outward attack, not by some rogue nation dropping an atomic bomb on us or someone distributing sarin gas in one of our institutions, such as a school or college or nursing home. The foundations are destroyed when you change the purpose. When you change the purpose of that entity. For instance, churches can be destroyed when you change the purpose of that church. Nations can be destroyed when you change the purpose for which that nation was founded, which was set forth in the preamble that I read to you. I don't think there'll be an armed uprising and rebellion. But I do think there are entities that are nibbling at the foundations of our nation to change its fundamental purpose. And I know that many churches have changed their purposes for the very reason that God sent them and set them up in this world to adhere to and to perform. They changed the purpose, and not perhaps even knowing themselves that they were changing. It was not an instant metamorphosis where they changed from the butterfly to the larva. but gradually moving in a direction, pushing to a certain agenda, that the foundations ultimately crumbled for no other purpose, no other reason, I should say, but that their purposes have changed. Again, let me read the purpose of our nation in the preamble. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and what our posterity, to our children. They were thinking ahead. This is not just something that we want for ourselves. We want it for our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, for all who live in America, who are citizens of this country. We want liberty. And we do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States. As I said, sometimes churches forget their Constitution, which is the Bible. We become a social institution by appealing to the world in order to fill up the church. And when you fill up the church with worldly ideas, with worldly appeal, you get a church full of worldlings. And this is about as plain as I know how to state it. If any person in this church doesn't want to be guided by the Bible, or the Bible hinders you in doing what you want to do or would do if you could, don't try to change us. Go to a church that's already changed. Remember the words of warning from Paul, a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump. But the Constitution, not being divinely inspired, but imperfect, will need changes from time to time, but its purpose will never change unless we change it. And in Washington's farewell address, he spoke of not being anxious or quick to change the purpose of our nation. Now, we do have a process for amendments, but amendments are very difficult because it takes Congress, both houses. It takes the states ratifying it before it can become a constitution, a constitutional change or amendment. Sometimes it takes years. It is a slow process, and it ought to be a slow process. But here's what Washington said in his memorable last address to the government. Towards the preservation of our government and the permanency of your present happy state, it is requisite not only that you steadily discountenance irregular oppositions to its acknowledged authority, but also that you resist with care the spirit of innovation upon its principles, however specious the pretext. One method of assault may be to effect in the forms of the Constitution alliterations which will impair the energy of the system and thus to undermine what cannot be directly overthrown. In all the changes to which you may be invited, remember that time and habit are at least as necessary to fix the true character of governments as of other human institutions, time and experience. What has time taught us about our nation and other nations? What have we learned from history? What has experience taught us? And you can apply the same thing to a church. What does the history of our church teach us? And what does our own experience teach us about the purpose of a church? As of other human institutions, that experience is the sure standard by which to test the real tendency of the existing constitution of a country. I'll not read the rest of it. But what he's saying is, be very careful about making changes in the Constitution, because changes may limit the liberty that we all cherish so very, very much. They may change the purpose of our nation. Many constitutions are similar to our Constitution, since we as a nation set the standard for a republican form of government, that is, a democratic election of representatives and senators. But they have failed. Germany failed as a democratic republic. Why? Because they wanted revenge on the nations that had conquered them in World War I. They wanted to rule the world. They wanted power. And it started by destroying the innocent and the helpless. The first people that felt the power of fascism under Hitler's dictatorship were the people who were in the mental institutions. They were a drain on the finances. We need all the money we can get to build ships, to have our army, so that we can conquer the nations around us and rule them. And the records are still intact. An archive that tells us of the doctors and the methods they used to destroy the helpless people who would not produce for the society the reign of 1,000 years that they dreamed of. Then the Jews were singled out as a hindrance to the nation, and they had to be annihilated. Genocide was practiced upon a race of people out of hatred and anger and fear of them. So we need to be careful of amendments. And in this same address to the in his farewell address to Congress, he also said that the separation of powers must stay intact. The executive, legislative, and judicial must mind their own business. And one of the assaults on the foundation that our fathers laid for us have been the assaults that have been made by the judicial system, who did not interpret the Constitution correctly, but for their own personal reasons and their own agendas, they set forth a practice or overruled a principle. And so our Constitution, or rather our lives, have been affected by judicial fiat rather than constitutional amendment. Our state cannot have an anti-abortion law because they've declared it unconstitutional. There are many other laws and rules and regulations that have not been brought about by amendment, but by the simple statement of some bureaucracy that exists. I was traveling in northern Italy one time, going to a landmark that I hoped to see. And as I walked along the trail, there was a tree lying by the trail and a McCulloch chainsaw sitting beside it. It's kind of unusual in a foreign country. But after I had gone and seen the place that I thought held a very important part in church history, there were men who were there, a couple of them, and I stopped to talk to them. And I said, "Are you going to cut up the tree?" And they said, "Yes, as soon as the people get here who give us permission." And I said, "Well, who owns this land?" They said, "We do." And I said, "Well, who's going to come and tell you whether you can cut it up or not?" He said, "Well, we have inspectors sent by our government that certifies that we can cut up this tree, and then they will tell us how many trees we have to replant and where we have to replant them before we can cut this one up." I don't operate that way on my 5 acres. I'll cut every tree down if I want to. I don't want a visit from the feds about my trees. But it'll happen. It will happen. And that's another reason you ought to pray for Jesus to come back real quick. So things can be changed just because someone thinks it would be better to change from what we are to something else. And I know the Supreme Court makes decisions that cause us to change, but sometimes, we're governed by crises. Not the Constitution, but by, "We have to do it now or we'll all die. We'll all starve to death if we don't do it within the next 2 days." And so we govern by crisis. Now, when we're attacked, as we were in Japan, go to war. Do something about it. I think there have been people who've tried to change the purpose of the Word of God, but it can't be amended. And there's a curse upon anyone who would take from or add to it. And I believe that's a serious curse that God placed upon people who would want to change the Bible. Because it's the document that tells us not only how to live here, but it gets to a place where we live hereafter. Both of these documents are soaked in blood. Our Bible came to us in old times by holy men who were born along by the Holy Spirit. And Jeremiah paid a price. Isaiah paid a price. All these men paid a price. And then the very crown jewel of God's universe, His dear Son Jesus Christ, came, was mistreated, beaten with stripes, humiliated. The Creator of all the earth and everything in the universe, He died on the cross, shedding His blood so that our sins could be forgiven. Yes, our Bible is a bloody book. And our Constitution is bathed in blood. And we've defended it. That's the oath that people take when they go into the military service of any kind. They swear to defend the Constitution of the United States, not the President, not Congress, but we the people. millions of true followers have died to keep the faith that the Bible teaches. And it may be that others will add their blood before the age comes to an end. Our Constitution is the product of revolution. Hundreds died to deliver us from the tyranny of a monarch. And our victory over the British gave us our freedom, but freedom without a guide to govern creates chaos. If we had just been freed of the oppressive system of being colonies, we would have gone to war one with another. Abraham Lincoln said that this whole civil war is being fought with the idea that a government of the people and by the people and for the people can long endure upon this earth. Will we literally fight ourselves out of existence, or will we form a document, and can we defend that document until it creates a peaceful tranquility and a liberty and freedom under which we may live our lives before God, our Creator? On Independence Day, we thank God, who by His grace and providence has granted to us both freedom and liberty. Physical freedom from tyranny. Physical freedom to have liberty, which is the exercise of choice. If a person's in jail and they unlock the door and he walks out, he has freedom. But now he must choose the things that his liberty has given him. And that's where we stand. We have been freed from the tyranny of monarchs, kings. But we may very well enslave ourselves to chaos unless we corporately agree to abide by the Constitution of our nation. I want to read this excerpt from Washington's farewell address, because it addresses an issue that I think will probably not be well received. And what he spoke of in this address is the idea of partisanship. What do we mean by partisanship? Well, when parties struggle against one another for their own purpose rather than for the purpose of serving the people of the nation. Let me now take a more comprehensive view and warn you in the most solemn manner against the baneful effects of the spirit of party. Generally, this spirit, unfortunately, is inseparable from our nature, having its root in the strongest passions of the human mind. It exists under different shapes in all governments, more or less stifled, controlled, or repressed. But in those of the popular form, it is seen in its greatest rankness and is truly their worst enemy. The alternate domination of one faction over another, sharpened by the spirit of revenge natural to party dissension, which in different ages and countries has perpetrated the most horrid enormities, is itself a frightful despotism. But this leads at length to a more formal and permanent despotism. The disorders and miseries which result gradually incline the minds of men to seek security and repose in the absolute power of an individual. And sooner or later, the chief of some prevailing faction, more able or more fortunate than his competitors, turns this disposition to the purpose of his own elevation on the ruins of public liberty. The common and continual mischiefs of the spirit of party. If you wonder what party is, it's Republican, Democrat, Independent, Green, or whatever else, where that party means more to you than the good of your country. It serves always to distract the public councils and enfeeble the public administration. It agitates the community with its ill-founded jealousies and false alarms, and kindles the animosity of one part against another. It foments occasionally riot and insurrection. It opens the door to foreign influence and corruption, which find a facilitated access to the government itself through the channels of party passions. Thus, the policy and the will of one country are subjected to the policy and will of another. There is a saying, a maxim, and it was what ruled Rome as a nation for a long, long time, and that is, to the victor belongs the spoils. To the victor belongs the spoils. We see ourselves divided in America along party lines. When one party gets power, they throw out the other party. When that party gets back in power, they take revenge. And none of it is good for our nation. I'll conclude my short essay into truth by reading an article that I thought was probably the best one I had read in quite a long time, because it is taken from a writing of Alexander Tyler, the University of Edinburgh, and he wrote this in 1787. A democracy is always temporary in nature. It cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It is clarified in this fashion, that is the statement I just read. A democracy will continue to exist up until the time that voters discover that they can vote themselves gifts from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates who promise the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that every democracy will finally collapse due to loose fiscal policy, which is followed by a dictatorship. The average age of the world's greatest civilizations from the beginning of history has been roughly 200 years. During those 200 years, these nations always progress through the following sequence, and I want you to pay attention. This is the sequence. From bondage to spiritual faith. From spiritual faith to great courage. From courage to liberty. And from liberty to abundance. From abundance to complacency. From complacency to apathy. From apathy to dependence. From dependence back to bondage. Let's stand and sing.